Sherry Wilson asked me a month or so ago if I would come give this talk, and I have my wife, Vanessa, over here, who tells me what to do at home, and I have Sherry, who tells me what to do at work. So I'm glad my two harshest critics are here. But I've done a lot of speaking here at church. We've been members here at Dawson for 8 years. I've done a lot of speaking about urology, but I've never mixed the two. So this is going to be a new adventure for me. But I hope that this will be beneficial. I really am passionate about speaking about prostate health. Obviously, I deal with it every day, but there's so much misinformation out there, and you can't watch a ball game without seeing two people in bathtubs, or hearing about men's health clinic and low T. And so really what I want to do tonight is just kind of give an overview of prostate health, and we're going to cover several issues. I know most of you are here to talk about prostate cancer, and I promise we'll spend the majority of the time talking about prostate cancer, but I want to spend a little bit of time talking about enlargement, because those of you that don't have prostate cancer, if you live long enough, you're going to have prostate enlargement. I want to talk a little bit about low testosterone, erectile dysfunction, and then prostate cancer, and some of the things that are out there, some of the newer treatments, advances that we've made. So let's just start by talking about what is the prostate and what does it do. And I tell patients a lot of times, I make a comparison about the prostate and the uterus in a female. And you say, well, how does that make sense? Well, the prostate is very important during childbearing years and when you're trying to have children. After you've had all the children that you want, it's very similar to the uterus, because the only things that can happen to it are bad. It can enlarge, or you can get cancer. But the prostate is the male sex gland, and it provides nutrients for the sperm. It's located in the pelvis at the base of the bladder, and it's kind of like a donut surrounding the urethra. And so when a man voids, the urine goes right through the center of the prostate. And so the prostate and the seminal vesicles, and you have a pair of seminal vesicles, make most of the fluid that nourish sperm. And the reason I wanted to show this picture is because it is important. Some of the advances that we have as far as surgical techniques have been wonderful because of the location of the prostate. And the prostate is deep in the pelvis. And before robotic surgery came along, it's a difficult place to get to. And so I definitely wanted to show a picture, because a lot of people do not know where the prostate is. But you can see it's just anterior, just in front of the rectum, and just below where the pubic bone would be. So I want to spend just a few minutes talking about BPH. And if any of you feel like you need to get up and go to the bathroom while I'm talking, that's perfect. Most men will experience symptoms of enlargement of the prostate at some point. And the symptoms are primarily getting up at night. I didn't want to do that. Getting up at night. Decreased force of stream, maybe straining, starting and stopping, and feeling of incomplete emptying. I've put, there's a piece of paper called the AUA symptom score in front of you. And any of you that would like can take a few minutes after you get home and look at that and fill it out. But it asks seven questions, and it kind of gives us an idea, as well as you, how severe a patient's symptoms are. It's amazing, some men will come in and tell me they get up four or five times a night to go to the bathroom and it doesn't bother them. Well, I'm sorry, if I'm getting up four or five times a night, I'm gonna be grumpy. And but, you know, it bothers people differently, and some people don't have trouble going back to sleep. But that symptom score is very useful because we follow it and have men fill it out. And then when we treat with medications or we do surgery, I always like to get them to fill it out again and see whether we've made progress, and it helps them as well. There are a lot of treatments available now for BPH, and this has changed dramatically just in the time that I've been in practice. The medications are the first line of treatment, and probably the one that most people have heard of is Flomax. But Flomax, Uroxetrol, Rapaflow, and Hytrin, Cardura, those drugs are what we call alpha blockers, and they work by relaxing the muscles in the prostate and in the bladder neck. And it helps with the force of stream, emptying. The other drugs that are probably more talked about and certainly more advertised, Avodart and Proscar, are drugs that shrink the prostate. But they take time to work. And so if your doctor starts you on one of these, it's probably gonna be 3 to 6 months before you see improvement. Whereas with Flomax, Hytrin, those drugs, you're gonna see an immediate improvement. But the Proscar and Avodart will shrink and continue to shrink the prostate while as long as you take them. There are several minimally invasive treatments, probably the most talked about with microwave therapy. It's very rarely done anymore. When it first came out, we thought it was gonna be great because it was a procedure that could be done in the office. There, we still do some, but the thought was that it heats the prostate and will help with resolving a lot of the obstruction, and it works for a while. And most men that have the microwave therapy were able to get off medications, but about a year down the road, they were back on them. And so while it was a non-invasive office procedure, we didn't get the lasting effects from it. Surgical treatments, the gold standard is the traditional TURP, and that stands for transurethral resection of the prostate. And I'm going to show you a video of a procedure that I'm doing now and have been doing for a couple of years called the TUVP, or transurethral vaporization of the prostate. We've tried several procedures to remove the tissue around the urethra. And you remember the picture I showed you of the urinary tract, the urethra going right through the center of the prostate. And so when we do these procedures, we do it through the urethra with a scope, and we, with the traditional TURP, we actually remove tissue. And we would send that tissue to the pathologist for them to look at and make sure there's no cancer. Well, very rarely do you find prostate cancer in the tissue directly surrounding the urethra. And so we realize that it's not critical to send that tissue to the pathologist. And so the only problems really with the traditional TURP is that patients have to be admitted to the hospital, they have a catheter in their bladder for one or two nights, and they're on irrigation because they have bleeding with it. Not bleeding where they have to be transfused, but blood in the urine, it can make it difficult to urinate. So all of these treatments that have come, or procedures that have come since then are looking to try to get the same effects of the transurethral resection without the bleeding and the stay in the hospital. So the green light laser is out there, and I've got some of my partners that's the only procedure really that they do. And it vaporizes the tissue, but laser causes a lot of what we call irritative voiding symptoms, where right afterwards patients would come in for a week or two and they were complaining of burning and frequency, going to the bathroom every 5 to 10 minutes, and they were miserable for a couple of weeks, and they were like, I can't believe I let you do this to me. Eventually they were happy, but initially they were struggling. Let me show you this video. Let's see. I'm going to kneel down because I'm going to stop it at a couple of points here. All right, so let me stop this here. That's kind of fuzzy. All right, so this area here, this is in the urethra, this is the prostate, and remember, the prostate, think of it as a donut, and you have tissue that, well, you'll see it actually fall in and cause blockage. The bladder is up here, and you'll see that a little bit better here in just a second. This button that you see is, it's electrical energy, and you see it's vaporizing the tissue. And you'll see that tissue fall in from laterally, from the sides. And this, and you can see there's essentially no bleeding at all with this tissue, with this procedure. If you do run into bleeding, and you'll see a little bit here, it's very easily controlled by stepping on a different pedal to cauterize. I'm not going to bore you with making you watch the whole thing, but what I want to show you is the end result. You remember what it looked like when we started. Let's get on over here, and this is, I hope I don't make anybody nauseated here, but so this is the very top that's being done now, and I'm going to stop it here in just a second and just show you how wide open the bladder neck and prostate area is when he's finished. And these patients can... There you go. I'm going to stop it there. All right, so now you see that ridge that we started off with. There was tissue up here when we started. And now there's no tissue on either side. There's essentially no ridge at all. And so he's got a very large opening, and he may be in the neighborhood showing off afterwards that he's going to be able to tell a big difference in the way he urinates. There's very little bleeding. They have a catheter overnight. They go home that day, so there's no admission to the hospital. We actually teach the patient to take the catheter out the next morning. Very easy. They take it out early the next morning, and then they have all day to make sure they can void. If they have problems, they come to the office, and we keep them out of the emergency room. They kind of take it easy for a couple of weeks. They can all get off of their medications by 2 weeks. As this lining kind of heals back over, there's no burning. They are very, very happy patients. So this has been a really good procedure for us, and it lasts generally 10 to 15 years and sometimes more. All right, I want to spend just a second talking about erectile dysfunction. You can't turn on the radio or, like I said, the TV without having commercials about this. And so I just want to say that the only thing that I want to say is there are a lot of misconceptions out there. This is an issue that is very important to men, women. It's very easily treatable. the medications have definitely revolutionized the treatment over the past several years. Most of these medications are very effective with minimal side effects. They're very safe as long as you're not taking nitroglycerin or long-acting nitrates for the heart. If the medications don't work, there are other treatments, injection therapy, vacuum device, and even prosthetic procedures that can be done. At urology centers, we have a clinic that's devoted to just ED. It's very professionally run, very private, and every patient that I've ever sent is very thankful because men can get treatment, and the main thing is just to know that that treatment is available. Sometimes I want to tell my patients this, but there's treatment. I want to spend just a second talking about low testosterone because this is a hot button topic. And low T this. I want you to pay attention over the next few weeks when you're in your car and you happen to turn on sports radio or whatever. About 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you'll start hearing commercials, Alabama Men's Clinic, low testosterone. Well, why is that? Well, testosterone, decreased testosterone, has many symptoms. And if you ask any man about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, are you tired? Are you run down? Your sex drive down? Well, yeah, everybody can answer that. Well, why? Testosterone is highest early in the morning. So if you have a testosterone level drawn, you need to have it drawn in the morning to be accurate. At 5 in the afternoon, it's about as low as it's going to go. That's when those commercials come on. Are you tired? Are you run down? There's a reason for that. But low testosterone can be, you can have decreased energy, decreased sex drive, depression, decreased muscle mass. There are a wide range of normal levels. And as I say, they vary throughout the day. As far as treatment, there have been a lot of improvements in this area as well. 10 or 15 years ago, the only treatments were testosterone injections, and you would have to get a testosterone injection usually every 2 weeks. And now there are gels, there are patches, there are actually pellets that can be implanted as in an office-based procedure that takes about 5 to 10 minutes, and you do it a couple of times a year. It's very important when men start testosterone therapy that the levels are followed and you have them checked regularly because there are problems with testosterone replacement. It can cause the blood to thicken and your hematocrit level can raise to dangerous levels to even cause strokes. And there have been cases of patients who were taking testosterone injections and man, they felt great. And then all of a sudden they have a stroke because their hematocrit's too high. Has to be monitored. The other thing that's important to know is testosterone replacement. The Lord knew what he was doing when he made the body. And testosterone is produced in the testicles, but it gets a message from the brain, the pituitary gland, to produce testosterone. Hey, we need testosterone. Once the testicles produce testosterone, there's a shut-off valve. It's a message back to the brain, hey, we got enough, shut it down. When you fool that by taking testosterone injections or creams or whatever, then the brain says, hey, we got enough, shut her down. So your own production stops. So what a lot of patients don't understand and what a lot of doctors don't do a very good job of, frankly, is telling a patient, when you start a man at age 45 on testosterone replacement, guess what? You're in this for the long haul. And so a lot of guys say, hey, this makes me feel a whole lot better. Okay, well, that's great. Are you willing to stay on it now for the next 30, 40 years? there are things that you can do to raise your own testosterone. One is treat sleep apnea. If you treat sleep apnea, it'll raise the testosterone level 50 to 100 points. If you exercise and lose weight, it'll raise the testosterone level 50 to 100 points. And I always chuckle when somebody comes in and says, "Doc, I'm tired and I'm run down." And I say, "Well, go exercise." Well, I wouldn't be here if I could exercise. But that is, you know, that's very true, that exercise will increase testosterone levels. All right, I want to spend the rest of the time talking about prostate cancer. A lot of people in this room have been affected very closely by prostate cancer. It's very common. It is the most common cancer in men. 1 in 6 men will be affected by prostate cancer. It is the second most common cause of death behind lung cancer. The key to treatment is definitely early diagnosis. PSA screening has led to a 40% decrease in prostate cancer deaths. Now we'll start preaching here. I'm just going to warn you. There have been a lot of things recently, and we have a federal task force that has now come out saying that we don't need to be doing prostate screening the way we've been doing it. Remember, I just showed you a slide that cannot be refuted, that prostate cancer deaths are down 40% since the PSA has come around. A lot of you in this room are here because you had a PSA and had screening, and you're going to be here for a long time because you had screening. But on this federal task force, which I might say there was no urologist and no oncologist, they came to the conclusion that we do not need to screen men until they reach the age of 55, and now we are supposed to start screening in men age 55 to 70. We screen men in age range of 40 to 55 in high-risk patients. Now, what's a high-risk patient? Just like Debbie said, if your dad had prostate cancer, get screened and start at age 40. First-line relatives, sons, brothers, they need to be screened early. African-American men are at higher risk, so we start screening earlier in these patients. Another thing that has come up is, when do you stop? At what point do you stop? And let me back up and just say, one of the criticisms of the PSA screening has been that there are too many unnecessary biopsies. Now, let's define unnecessary, because my definition of unnecessary and their definition probably going to be a little bit different. If you take all the patients that we do biopsies on for prostate cancer or for elevated PSA, across the board, there's about a 35% positive rate. All right? Now, the way they look at that is that's 65% that are done unnecessarily. The way I look at it is, if I tell you you've got a 35% chance of having a curable cancer, do you want it done? Do you want a diagnosis? I would say that's not unnecessary if it comes back negative. But that's, again, a message for another day. Most cancers now are found microscopically. We don't see as many. When I was a resident just a few years ago, a lot of the cancers that we found were because patients had come in and they'd lost 50 or 60 pounds, or they had, you know, symptoms of metastatic disease. With the PSA screening, we really don't see as much of that. So let's talk about diagnosis. We generally diagnose this by transrectal ultrasound and biopsy, which is an office-based procedure. We use local anesthetic. Generally, I give patients some oral Valium, 10 milligrams of Valium. It's not a procedure that you come back and ask, hey, will you do it again on me next week? But it's a 10-minute procedure. Most patients have very few problems with it. They're sore for a few days, may have some bleeding for a few days. We treat with antibiotics to try to prevent infection, and generally most men tolerate it well. Now, there are some men in here that might take issue to that statement that you've had it and know, but generally most men tolerate it very well, and it's generally a low-risk procedure. I want to talk a little bit about staging. And staging with prostate cancer is a little different than staging with some other cancers, because this is an area that, honestly, we need to get better. When we diagnose prostate cancer, we use a patient's PSA, their rectal exam, that's digital rectal exam, the Gleason score. And a Gleason score is determined by the pathologist that looks at the tissue under the microscope. And without going into real detail, we grade it on a scale of 2 to 10, with 2 being the least aggressive and 10 being the most aggressive. Most prostate cancers fall in the 5, 6, 7 range. But that helps us. If somebody comes in and we do a biopsy and they have every single pore positive and it's a Gleason 9, I'm going to treat that patient a lot differently than I am a man that has one core that's positive, one out of 12 that's positive with a Gleason score of 4 or 5. Those are two totally different prostate cancers. They're both prostate cancer, but they act totally differently. Occasionally, we will get a CT scan or a bone scan. We generally only get a bone scan if a PSA is over 20 or if it's in a situation like I just described where every core is positive and you're worried about spread. CT scans in prostate cancer, and we do have a radiologist here, he'll back me up on this, they're really not helpful in most cases. Occasionally we'll see some enlarged lymph nodes, but most of the time they're not helpful. MRI is something that I think every meeting that I go to, there's a little bit more excitement about possibly using MRI both in the diagnosis, but also in the staging of prostate cancer. But as I said, this is an area that we really need to improve. Treatment options. I put up here dependent on age, health, staging, patient preference. Some of y'all in here have heard this speech before, but I treat patients with prostate cancer differently depending on their age, the amount of cancer that they have in their biopsy, the Gleason score, and honestly, and I tell patients this right up front, at this point, once I've done a biopsy and we find cancer, and I sit down with that patient, I tell them, I'm trying to do something right now that only the Lord can do, and that is predict how long you're going to live and predict, is this cancer ever going to cause you any trouble before something else gets you? Well, y'all know I can't do that. But we do try to tailor our treatment. I'm going to treat a 50-year-old with prostate cancer differently than I am a 75-year-old who's had a heart attack and has diabetes and high blood pressure, because it's just a different ballgame for those two people. So what are our treatment options? Well, something that is becoming more and more in vogue is what we call active surveillance. And I'm going to talk about each one of these, but let me just say something about active surveillance. That is different than observation, okay? That's different than just watching it. What we do with active surveillance, let's just say I have a 75-year-old patient who had a PSA of 5 or 6, had one core out of 12 positive, and it's a Gleason 4 or 5. That patient is a very good candidate for active surveillance. Now, what does that mean? Well, PSAs are not perfect in diagnosing cancer. They're very good in following cancer after you've treated it. But we use a PSA. We'll bring that patient back every 3 months. We'll examine them. We'll do a PSA. And every year, for the first 2 or 3 years, we'll bring them back and we'll do another biopsy. And at that biopsy, if that biopsy, and I've got one patient right now that I biopsied in 2 consecutive years, both years he's had one core in the same spot, because we label where we get the tissue from, one core in the same spot, Gleason 5, he's now in his third year, it hasn't progressed, his PSA's not changing. In my mind, he's probably made a good decision and he may never have to have any treatment. But you can't just say, well, this probably is not going to cause you trouble, come back in a year, because they can get away from you. Surgical removal. This is an area that has changed dramatically over the last 10 years, and we'll talk about that. Radiation therapy. There are two different types of radiation therapy right now that are the most common curative treatments for prostate cancer. External beam radiation therapy and brachytherapy. Androgen ablation or hormone therapy. Prostate cancer feeds off of the male hormone testosterone. We used to have to, in advanced cases of prostate cancer, patients would have an orchiectomy or removal of the testicle to remove the source of testosterone. Now, thankfully, there are injections that can do that, so men don't have to go through that surgery. The other advantage of the injections is you can start and stop them. You can have a man take injections for 6 months, a year, 2 years, and if they're doing well, you can stop them and give them a vacation for a while and then start it back as you need to. Other treatments that are being talked about now, cryosurgery, we're doing some, high intensity focused ultrasound and proton therapy. Let's spend a minute kind of going through each one of these. Prostatectomy, removal. When I was in residency, when I was in residency, we had basically open prostatectomy. And you could do it either by a retropubic or an incision from the belly button down to the pubic bone, or perineally, which is the area just in front of the rectum. Remember that first picture I showed you of where the prostate is? We were operating in a hole. It didn't matter whether the man was thin or whether he weighed 250 pounds. Now, we preferred the one that weighed 150, but those cases could be difficult. We lost a lot of blood. Patients were in the hospital generally 2 to 3 days. They had a catheter in their bladder 2 to 3 weeks. And then along comes the robot. And the robot has changed our life and a lot of men's lives. The goal for surgery, or goals for surgery, we're gonna obviously try to cure the patient. And we generally try to recommend surgery in patients that have localized disease, obviously, because if they have disease outside the prostate, why are we going to remove the prostate? We're not going to cure it. So we want to cure the cancer, first of all, but we also want to preserve urinary control and sexual function. Urinary control, I tell men this all the time, as most of you are sitting here, your brain's not telling your bladder, oh, we got to hold on to urine, we got to hold on to urine. It does that for you. And that's because the muscles in the bladder neck control that. Once you cut across that bladder neck to remove the prostate, then you lose that control. Sexual function, we've talked about. The Da Vinci robot, this is just a picture of the robot, and I've got a closer up picture, but this is the robot. This is the console. The surgeon actually sits here and he puts his hands in little controls, and based on movements of his hand, these arms of the robot right here are we have little stab incisions in the patient, and those arms are moving. The arms of that robot can get in positions that your hand cannot get in. And when the surgeon is at the console, he is looking at a three-dimensional picture of tissue this far away from the tissue that he is cutting and sewing. It's an unbelievable picture. The prostate can be removed robotically in about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Patients have a catheter in their bladder for 1 week. They're hospitalized overnight. It's amazing. You go up the afternoon of surgery and they look just like you guys. Some of you in here have had that. There's pain, there's soreness. The worst part, most people would tell you, is the catheter in the bladder. The bladder knows that the Lord did not intend to have the catheter in it, and it spasms and it tries to push it out. And so that is the worst part. So men will gladly trade a week with a catheter versus 2 to 3 weeks. So the robot has really made some improvements. Radiation, I want to talk about that. The IMRT, or intensity modulated radiation therapy, same goals. We want to cure the cancer, we want to have minimal side effects. The advantage of this type of radiation is it's a non-invasive procedure. Basically, these machines, and I'm going to show you a picture of our machine, of the linear accelerator at Homewood, but these machines are accurate to within a millimeter or two. Incredibly accurate. 15, 20 years ago, if you had radiation for the prostate, they'd radiate you from about here to here, and they'd give you a big blast of radiation. It'd kill the cancer, but there are a lot of other things between there that it would kill as well, and the side effects were really bad. Now with this type of radiation, they break it up into fractions, and they'll give you 40 treatments or 40 fractions over about an 8-week period of time. They take 10 to 15 minutes. Patients generally tolerate them extremely well. The downside of this type of treatment is that it's daily for 6 to 8 weeks. Any type of radiation, you can have some bladder and bowel dysfunction, and long term, you can have sexual dysfunction. This is a picture of our linear accelerator at our Homewood office. And as I said, very accurate treatment is very good. Brachytherapy. Some of you in here, most of you have heard about brachytherapy. Some of you in here have had brachytherapy. Brachytherapy is just radiation seed implants. They look like little pencil leads. And the way these are implanted, it's an outpatient procedure under anesthesia. The radiation oncologist has a computer program. They measure the size of the prostate. They determine how many seeds the prostate needs. Generally, it's about 80 to 100 seeds. The computer maps out exactly where in the prostate those seeds need to be placed, and using ultrasound guidance, the urologist will place needles into the prostate in those specific areas. The radiation oncologist comes in behind and drops the seeds in. We pull the needles out, and they show up on every x-ray that you ever have from now on. The procedure takes an hour and a half to 2 hours. It's a very good procedure in patients that have low to medium, moderate grade disease. Not a great treatment in patients that have high-grade disease or a lot of cores positive, because as you can see, you can only get these seeds in the prostate. You can't make them float around the prostate, and so they're not going to treat any disease outside of the prostate. In some places, they'll give a combination of seeds and external beam radiation therapy. Cryotherapy, just very briefly. First tried in the 60s and 70s, poor results. Transrectal ultrasound and what we call urethral warming mechanisms have improved the results with cryotherapy. The principle behind cryotherapy is if you get cells cold enough, they'll die. Minus 40 degrees, pretty cold. That's the ideal temperature. We currently reserve these for radiation failures. It's not a first-line treatment yet, but there's still a lot of work being done. This is just a close-up picture of what cells look like after they've been frozen, and it kills them. There are some side effects to this. Patients can have a lot of irritative voiding symptoms and some rectal issues as well. Hormonal therapy, I talked a little bit about that. There are several agents available. Most of these are given every 3 months. This Viadur is actually a little office procedure where we insert this medicine into the just under the skin, and it is a year-long treatment. This is commonly used in advanced disease, recurrent disease, whether they've had surgery or radiation. If there's a recurrence, you can place patients on hormonal treatment. Generally, hormonal treatment is not a curative treatment. Occasionally, it's used in conjunction with radiation as a curative type treatment, but alone, hormonal therapy is not a curative treatment. Eventually, prostate cancer cells get smart and they become resistant to the hormone treatment. The average length of response is anywhere from 18 to 24 months. I've got some guys that I've started and stopped, and they're going on 5 or 6 years that have been on it. So some patients do very well with this. This is the area of excitement. If I had given this talk 5, 6 years ago, it would have ended with that last slide. It's not ending with that last slide today, because chemotherapy, there are a lot of drugs out there now that are very exciting and are actually prolonging life. Provenge is a novel treatment. It's an immunotherapy where you go in, you have plasmapheresis, where they actually take the white cells, the cells that fight infection, they take them, they wash them, they pair them with an antigen, put it back in. It takes 10 days, 2 weeks for them to prepare this. They reinfuse it, and it actually stimulates the immune system to fight cancer. It's amazing. And the results have been very promising. We currently use this in patients that have metastatic disease, have a positive bone scan, but they're asymptomatic. They don't have any pain from it. It has been shown to prolong survival as much as 6 months to a year in some of these patients. The Zytiga, docetaxel, Jeftana, and Xtandi, all of these are chemotherapy drugs. And honestly, right now where we are is they're doing studies trying to figure out, can we start these treatments earlier and earlier in the process rather than waiting until you're in a dire situation. But as you know, FDA, you gotta have these studies to prove that it's worthwhile and it prolongs survival. But this area is very, very exciting. We went through this with testicular cancer, and now we're to the point where you can have a person like Lance Armstrong with brain cancer from metastatic testicular cancer, chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, and he's, you know, doping up and winning. The last thing I really want to talk about is we now know a lot more about bone health, and both in women and in men. But we know that if you suppress hormones, it affects bone, and you can have osteoporosis. And so if you have men on hormonal therapy, they need to have calcium, vitamin D, and there are several of these drugs that are injections as well as oral therapies that can help with preserving. The last slide, where are we going? We've got to find a screening test that is a perfect screening test. PSA is great, but it's not perfect, and we do have a lot of false positives with that. We need something that is both sensitive and specific. We're going to move, as I've mentioned, move more towards active surveillance in the right patients. As I mentioned, increased use of MRI and diagnosis and treatment, better staging. It would sure help if we could definitely tell a patient you have a positive lymph node before we do surgery, because that would affect how you treat a lot of patients. We're just not there yet. Earlier use of chemotherapy, diet and supplements. We do know for a fact that our nice Western diet, as you just ate some barbecue, high fat, low fiber diet is associated, they're higher risk of prostate cancer than the high fiber, low fat that Asians have. If you take Asian population, they have a very low incidence of prostate cancer. You move them to the US, their incidence of prostate cancer becomes the same as ours. So diet is definitely a part of that. There are various supplements out there. They're doing a lot of studies, but we don't know of, you know, a particular supplement right now that will prevent prostate cancer. There's a lot also on the molecular level, being able to test genetics and determine what patients are at risk for developing prostate cancer. Pretty exciting time.